You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
In a world filled with cigars, craft beer, comics, movies, and video games,
only two men are brave enough to search out all things nerdy.
It's the Cigar Nerds Podcast!
And this is Smokin' Joe.
And I'm Brad Jackson.
We're going to do things a little bit differently from now on. We're going to start doing our cigar intro as a separate segment. That way, you know, for some reason, if we're recording live or whatever and we can't, you know, smoke during our main segment, you'll still get your cigar news up front here, and so you can smoke along at home. And also, for this new segment, we're going to be sitting down with Tim Mullins, the owner of the cigar shop in Cumming, and he's going to be sending us his weekly recommendations of new and interesting cigars you should try.
And a little segment we'd like to dub Tim's Picks. And with this segment, one of the things we want to do is turn this into an interactive experience. Give you folks some advance notice so you can run out to your local cigar shops or, you know, if you're in the coming area, you know, make a pit stop by the home of the cigar nerds at the cigar shop and pick up your smokes. Yeah, I mean, we want, obviously, you know, you folks to visit the website. Give us your thoughts, your feedback on, you know, Tim's recommendations, our take on the cigars, and, you know, truly make this interactive. So, you know, we're going to take the good, the bad, the ugly, and we're going to start sharing it with you folks.
And as always, we'll give you our final thoughts after we've finished the cigar that that Tim has picked for us this week. So let's start off with our first edition of Tim's Picks.
And today we are smoking the Rocky Patel Super Ligero. I probably butchered that because
Ligero.
The whole R roll thing in
I took high school Spanish. I could pronounce half of this stuff.
Yeah, well, I mean, I did too, but that was high school. Part of high school is I don't remember much of it.
I didn't start drinking until after high school, so I still remember a lot of that stuff. Yeah, it's a Honduran cigar with a Habano wrapper and a Costa Rican Mexican filler, and it's described as a full-bodied cigar, but like I said, according to Tim's pick, it's a medium to full body. Like, it'll start off with a medium and then kind of
the full body starts, you know, really expressing itself, and you start truly getting, you know, a taste of this super badass Ligero leaf embedded inside. It's almost like a stick of dynamite for the amateur smokers.
Yeah, it's not as, I mean, I've had stronger, but yeah, this definitely builds up to it. It doesn't hit you right from the start.
Yeah, but as a cigar nerd, dude, how long have we been smoking cigars?
Yeah.
I mean, we definitely have a tolerance.
That's the thing about cigars, it's different for everybody's palate. And like I said, this has got a nice oily wrapper, constructed well. It'll hold up. It's not going to, you know, derail. You're going to get like a nice long ash, and it's a well-constructed cigar, so it's gonna hold up throughout the smoke.
Yeah, I mean, the oily texture of the leaf and everything, I mean, it's got a very good flavor to it.
What's the price point on this, Brad?
At this cigar here, you're about at the $8 price range, and, you know, and our typical cigar length, I mean, this is very budget-friendly smoke, I would say.
Yeah, like I said, it's not a Philly blunt. You're not going to buy it for a quarter.
This is definitely the type of cigar,
but this is a
folks,
good, decent, you know, intro price cigar. You're not spending a whole lot of money. This is, you know, $8. Yeah, it's a decent price for a cigar.
This is a cigar that you're going to sit down, you're going to relax, you're going to taste the smoothie creaminess of the leaf and everything else, and, you know, you're just going to indulge yourself. I mean, after all, that's what cigar smoking's all about.
And that's another great part about talking to Tim about these is that we'll get the proper terminology that we are too dumb to remember.
I don't think it's that we're too dumb. I mean, there's just a lot of science that goes behind it and a lot of marketing ploy. And, you know, here, folks, I'm not necessarily looking to, you know, market or, you know, to try to say, hey, you have to run out and buy the cigar. I mean, everybody's palate and tasting with alcohol and cigars and everything else varies. So, you know what
we just want to tell you what we enjoy so you can, yeah, maybe sample it and see if you enjoy it. And as always, you know, email us, tweet us, whatever, and, you know, give us your recommendations. We may try, you know, try something that, you know, we've not had that, you know, or if you think our opinion is shite, then
definitely call us out on it. I mean, I'm more than willing to take the good along with the bad. So, you know, we'll share it with the fan base out there, and, you know, let you folks have an opportunity to interact amongst yourself. I mean, that's one of the beauties of cigar smoking. I would say that everybody that's ever smoked their first cigar was probably in some form of, you know, amongst friends, whether it be a wedding or just sitting at a bar or something. And smoking a cigar is a memorable experience.
And as Mark Twain said, I smoke in moderation, only one cigar at a time. And with that, folks, we'll be back with our main segment. This is our board game episode, so we'll be right back.
Stay tuned.
Hey, give that back!
Mouse trouble? Then you need Mousetrap!
Mousetrap, I guarantee it's the craziest trap you'll ever see.
The first to capture everyone else's mouse is the winner.
Just turn the crank and snap the blank and boot the marble right down the chute. Now watch it roll and hit the bowl and knock the ball in the rubber top tar, which hits the man into the pan. The trap is set. Here comes the net.
Ouch!
Mousetrap, I guarantee it's the craziest trap you'll ever see.
I win!
I knew you were a winner. Mousetrap from Milton Bradley.
Shark Attack. Just roll the dice, and when your color comes up, move your fish fast.
The fish that survives will be the winner. So don't be last, or you'll be the dinner.
Shark Attack. What are you gonna do? It's coming. It's coming. It's coming. It's coming to get you.
Sink your teeth into Shark Attack.
And welcome to the Cigar Nerd Podcast. I'm Smokin' Joe.
And I'm Brad Jackson.
And welcome back to the Nerd Cave this week. We have another guest in. Like, we're starting to get a run of some, and it's not just us talking to ourselves anymore.
This is crazy. I mean, it's like the voice is in my head, only there's a live person sitting beside me now instead of across from
me. It's not us just imagining things anymore. This week's episode is going to be, you know, it's getting time to the holiday season and people looking for gift ideas. And board games are a huge thing right now. So we have Mike McGinnis from
the Tabletop Series.
We have Mike McGinnis from Enigma Nexus. Welcome to the Nerd Cave, sir.
Hey guys, thanks for having me.
So tell people a little bit about, you know, what you do and your credentials here to talk to us about games.
Okay, well, I'm an independent game designer. I've been designing games since about 2010. I've got 5 games either published or that I've helped on, and I've been to a couple conventions, Gen Con, MomoCon, and have been, I don't know, a lifelong gamer. So it's a passion of mine, even if I wasn't doing it for a hobby or for a career.
Oh yeah, it's always nice to do something that you like doing for a career. You know, and it doesn't feel like work if if it's already your hobby.
Oh yeah.
Now if we could just get paid for podcasting, it would.
it's okay because we got the passion for podcasting. So.
Like I said, board games, and yeah, we've all grown up playing them, and it seems like lately it's turned into more of a adult hobby than just the family Saturday night. But you know, where did gaming come from? Yeah, what are our origins of board games? It's not the late 70s, I'm assuming.
Oh no, yeah, board games have been around since ancient times, and we're finding like D20s and pyramids and board games buried with pharaohs from ancient times.
King Tut had a pretty strong D&D
Were those
character.
Board games, or was that like the form of timekeeping or something?
There's still some debate on that. But yeah, it was because there was all that war and famine, you got all these troubles, so why not try to condense it down into a way that's a little bit easier to manage? So you've had board games, like I said, throughout time. You had variations of chess since the 1300s. Go was in 300 BC or so, and then it's been developing ever since, because it's real easy to set up a blank space and a couple of pieces, and you can go wild with it.
Yeah, I think I read there was like an Egyptian game called Senet or whatever from like 3100 BC that they dug up in some pharaoh's tomb, and there's been other pharaoh's tombs that have like basically like the rules of a game written on the wall. So it's definitely been around for forever, pretty much.
So maybe hieroglyphics weren't maybe just a form of communication. Maybe it was actually a wall game played out.
you got a tic-tac-toe somewhere.
I mean, hey.
Dungeons & Dragons version 000.00.
I see what you did there.
And then after that, you know, you kind of start developing into more modern board games. Chess kind of developed in about the 1400s, brought over from Middle Eastern times. And then just with the advance of globalization early 1900s, and you see a lot more knowledge being shared around the world, and that's when you start seeing games like Monopoly come into play.
Yeah, the stuff we're all familiar, you know, kind of our childhood growing up, the family market. Yeah, I think it was like, so what's some like, you know, probably old, at least games from this country that that, you know, we've not heard of that, like I said, the America's gaming past.
Right. I mean, of course, you had, you know, the Monopoly was sort of the trigger back in the 1920s, but you'll have, there'll be scores of games you wouldn't hear of because it was a one-off or really local.
Yeah, I heard a lot of the old stuff, too, were almost like moral, like, you know, Bible-type games and stuff like that.
Right. There was like a temperance card game to teach people not to drink alcohol. And
yeah, that's bad. That's
that wasn't a very good seller.
No. That's the reverse of the drinking game, the not drinking game. That does not sound fun at all.
And then you had a lot of other games that came in. Like Sorry is actually a reskin of a game from India, Pachisi. So you'd actually have people just stealing ideas that were public domain or from other countries and just slapping their own name on it and make a quick
buck. Yeah, I mean, I guess before the interweb and everything else, I mean, it was a lot easier to be like, yeah, I'm going to take this guy's idea because unless you're going to India, you're probably not going to know any difference.
Yeah, and you know, 1920 or 1820, who's it's not like a global communication now, so like the people that are in California don't know what the people in New York are doing. You know, it's, you know, if you're copying something, it's going to be pretty obvious. But yeah, back then, yeah, and yeah, I don't know. Like I said, games probably have a base mechanic that, you know, you'll see like many developments of that same basis.
Right.
Like I said, you know, the Monopoly strategy. You know, that you probably see that in several different. You know, I'm sure there's some similarity in some games, and then there's stuff that's completely original that you've not ever seen before.
Yeah, you had for a while there in the early 20th century a lot of roll and move. That was the basic mechanic you'd see in all these games of Monopoly. You roll dice, you move your piece. Sorry, you roll your dice, move your piece. Then Risk, once that came around in the late 50s, you're rolling dice and you're moving pieces around. And that was basically all board games were for the longest time.
That still sounds like my board games.
Yeah, I mean, that's something you still see today is, you know, roll and move. That's the base mechanic of most games.
Yeah, that or it's roll and consume brains.
Yeah, some zombie dice.
Me and my crafty, go get some Sculpty and make 100 of these clay brains and see how that goes.
Yeah, we got tired of like trying to keep track of the zombie brains just on paper. So he actually got a mold and made a whole bunch of brains.
Oh, nice. Yeah, we're up to about 15 now. We started a year ago.
You need a few more, I think, for that game.
Yeah
you still got to keep going for brains.
See how quick my creativity goes out the window. Like, man, all right, I've got a mold and everything, and this still sucks.
Well, yeah, still speaking of the origins, what's some, say, you said Monopoly, what's some other like important developments as far as the you know, what's the big points in gaming history?
Okay. Well, speaking more toward the modern times, you know, your Monopoly is in the 1920s or so, Risk was 1959, and then you hit sort of a dry spot. There's a lot of... I mean, any kid growing up in the 70s and 80s were familiar with everything was plastic. You know, you had Mousetrap, you had...
Battleship.
Yeah, there wasn't much of a game there. You were buying a box of toys with a game built around it.
And you can never get that Mousetrap thing to work properly. I don't think I ever had it, like, go from start to finish and work
no,
the way
it... No, it was funny. That game never played out like it did in the commercials.
No.
And then starting in the late 70s, early 80s, you had this resurgence of things like Dungeons & Dragons started gaining popularity. And it started showing people that, hey, perhaps there's more to gaming than rolling a dice and moving a piece around. Even though that does a lot of dice rolling, it involves a lot more complex.
Yeah, there's a lot more like storytelling element to it, more, you know, creative stuff. It's not just, you know, oh, you've landed on Park Place, pay $200 or whatever it is.
Right.
Yeah, there's like, you know, you... Pretty much, but you know, I've not played a lot of Dungeons and Dragons, but I mean, there's a story. You have to. It's not right in front of you. It's a lot more creative element.
Yeah, and that creativity started to leak over into board games as well. You'd see board games have a little bit more of an expansive situation to them. Like HeroQuest came out, and that
I've still got the original HeroQuest, and
wait, don't you both mean expansive. BeroQuest?
Oh yes, we renamed it BeroQuest because we would. That we turned into a drinking game. We would make Death Kool-Aid too, which was it was energy drinks before Monsters. We just basically take this giant tub and you'd pick random Kool-Aid flavors and mix them together and then triple the sugar content. And you just, you know, drink out of this giant goblet of Kool-Aid. Oh, you'd play like a 3 or 4 hour session of HeroQuest, and you'd just be bouncing off the walls. Like, I'm surprised we didn't die from sugar comas from our old BeeroQuest segments yet. But I still have an original HeroQuest and the expansions. I used to love that game. We need to get another session of that going.
And that's just more of a, one of those things where the influence of D&D was starting to be felt. You saw a lot more fantasy stuff, even in like TV and movies, you know, Princess Bride and Willow and all these other, you know, high fantasy things were really starting to come into play at that time.
I mean, I think they added a whole certain dynamic. I mean, at that point, not are you just rolling a dice and moving a figurine, but you're truly developing a character. You're able to utilize your own strategy and things. And I think that ultimately that's what played and...
Yeah, and HeroQuest for me was a good like midway for because I didn't really get into the Dungeons and Dragons where it's just, you know, pen and paper, but that, you know, actually added the board game element to it and, you know, gave something physical to go along with your storytelling and you know, because you could build your own adventures and stuff in that game, but I it kind of was easier for me having an actual physical thing.
Something already laid out that we could have to spend hours of you know, time trying to, well, hold on, this doesn't quite work. Let's tweak this rule and...
Yeah, I've been to several sessions where you're developing a character for 3 hours and then you forget to actually play the game because you spent so much time on character development.
Yeah. And then I guess at that point people wanted just more immersive games. And then you saw in the 90s, that's basically when the floodgates opened. You had Magic the Gathering came out in 94, 95. Just huge, changed everything as far as it just... the focus on fantasy games, but also, hey, you're playing a powerful wizard. It brought in a lot of concepts that weren't seen before, and then it just really opened a lot of people's
eyes. Yeah, I mean, it's crazy how immense of, you know, the whole Magic the Gathering thing. I mean, I've still got, man, I've got 4 or 5 moving boxes full of decks and cards still sitting upstairs that I'll occasionally break out and just like, oh, man, I forgot how fun this was, and... You know, yeah, then I can't keep up with you know, all the new rules and everything else because I'm like, now I realize how much money I've invested into it and how expensive it is to keep it on going.
Yeah, I played a lot of poker. That was the only card game I played.
Well, see, I like poker, but there's an opportunity there for some return on investment. Yeah. So.
But then again, I've been playing the Star Wars tabletop game, and everybody's like, you got cards, man. It's just like Magic. You should play Magic. I'm like, no way, because there's X-Wings. Put me an X-Wing in Magic, then maybe I would get into it.
I got a ship that takes up the entire table, and you got an entire fleet, and you can't touch it.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically chess, but in a galactic level. Because it takes that same mechanics of you having to think 3 or 4 steps ahead of time to be able to you know, dogfight your way through the game of X-Wing. But yeah, there's been so many, you know, and we'll get into it eventually about the gaming renaissance that we're seeing today, but. Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about, you know, what you do as a game designer. Like where does, you know, what comes first? I mean, your mechanics, your story, you know, walk us through the, you know, how you go about creating a game.
Okay. Well, it can happen either from an idea of a mechanic or a theme. It can come either way. Some people, other designers I talk to are really hard one way or the other, but I'm open for whatever inspiration comes my way. Like one day I was watching a TV show about tornado chasers and I'm like, that'd make an awesome board game. So then I started figuring out, hey, what sort of things would tornado chasers have to run into? And they'd have to upgrade their vehicle to make sure debris wouldn't kill them. And they're trying to upgrade their camera to take
this is right up my alley. Yeah. You know, I can attest to the fact it's always been a lifelong dream of mine to be a storm chaser. And I've totaled one of my parents' cars in the process of doing so. So, I mean, dude, I'm ready to play right now.
All right. And then at that point, you know, I've got kind of a nebulous idea of what I want the game to be. So in this case, we'll go on with the Storm Chaser game. And I know that, hey, maybe some of the mechanics are that you'll run into tornadoes and they'll be of different categories. And how do I define that? And then so I look at either established mechanics, you know, you can roll a die to determine, or you can do a table, cards, just whatever better fits the theme and the flow of the game I'm going for at the time. Then at that point, I try to get up a prototype as quick as I can, get some friends over to test it, because I've actually got a stack of probably 30, 40 games that I've prototyped that I've shelved. You know, they had good ideas, but they're not ready to be a full-fledged game.
Anytime we need some game testers, we're always down here in the Nerf Cave trying to get a gaming night together.
Awesome. Always looking for those. But yeah, and then I get feedback from that and determine if it's an idea worth going on or if I would need to make some big changes, little changes, or if I want to go on to another project at that point. And it's just kind of a rinse and repeat, and, you know, get some play tests in, come up with ideas as I'm going through, match the theme to the mechanics back to theme. And at that point, I just keep playtesting until I get a pretty good consensus. Hey, this is a fun game. The problem is you can never please everybody all the time, but
yeah.
If you're happy with what you made, then...
Well, I mean, that's one of the things that I've seen a lot of the games. I mean, they definitely appeal to a certain niche of people instead of, you know, I guess more so trying to involve the entire family. It's become, hey, you're into zombies, so we've created zombie-themed games. Or, you know, you're into this TV show, so here's a spinoff game of that, you know, show and stuff like that. And, you know, I think that's added, you know, a lot to ultimately gather folks that would typically say, oh, man, you're playing a board game? I don't know if I'm into that so much. And
yeah, it's not so much the, you know, the Monopoly or the Connect Four.
Well, I mean, even, you know, your Monopolies and stuff. I mean, I think you got Star Wars Monopoly, you get, freaking Holiday Monopoly. I mean, how many different ways has Monopoly been rethemed over the years to try to appeal to whatever is popular in
culture? I haven't had the PC version of Monopoly, which is sad, because the whole point of playing a board game is to get social and get like a group of your friends together, but now you're sitting alone, like playing against like the AI of the computer, going, why the hell am I? I have the physical copy downstairs. I could call some people to come over, have some beers, and play some Monopoly, but I'm sitting here playing this. This stupid...
yeah, but you want to call everybody at midnight. I mean...
Hey, you know, I don't sleep. The rest of the world should join me in that. There's more fun that happens after dark.
I don't know, man. My dreams are pretty wild. But maybe that's a different show.
There's a game for us to design. You know, it's based on the crazy thoughts in Brad's head.
Dude, it would be the never-ending game. And I don't... Going back to, you know, mechanics and themes and everything, there'd be no way to make it work.
Oh, yeah, that's what we need, the cigar nerd board game. We already talked about the drinking game. We can have the board game like, oh, yo, you rolled a six, your humidor has dried out, go back three spaces. you're out of Anejo, lose a turn.
Lost $300.
Podcast guest canceled, miss a turn.
Lose 17 fans.
So where did this, you know, start for you? What was your first game and your first experience of getting your first published work?
Well, it started when I was a little kid. You know, it was one of those things. It was a childhood dream. No notebook of my mom's was safe from my marker, so I was drawing, you know, as many boards as I could. I didn't know if they'd be any good or what the mechanics were. I just loved the look of it and creating the worlds. And then about 2010, I ended up with a bunch of dice my buddy gave me. And I remember my childhood passion. Oh, I love making board games. And I was like, well, I've got these dice. What can I do with them? And then I started making a game, sort of a variant on Risk. And it got good. A lot of people started liking playing it. And I started developing, hey, what could I do otherwise? Now that I have the internet and all the powers it bestows upon me, I started researching and developed my first game, Impede. A very small game. It's basically a sheet of paper and 16 stones, but somebody said it was like checkers from a different dimension. So it has that sort of gameplay. It's very simple, but I was able to self-publish it, got a couple of copies out there, got my name out there, and that's sort of what started me, you know, making an Enigma Nexus and really pursuing board game development as strong as I am.
Yeah, I mean, dice, it's always fun to play with dice. I mean, even if you're not even playing a game, it's like someone sees a dice, they're going to pick it up and roll it. It's just, yeah, I mean, there's something addictive about it.
I think it's programmed into the human psyche.
I mean, how is the, you know, yeah. Spoiler, like, I've known Mike since we were, middle school or something.
Yeah, right,
it's been
about,
a while.
Yeah.
And, you know, nowadays with the internet and how much easier has it been to be an independent designer and be able to self-publish with the, you know, the resources that weren't available probably back in the day when we were making up games and
No, it is scores easier. I was reading about a lot of the people who came before me, a lot of independent designers, Gary Gygax, who made Dungeons and Dragons. There's stories of him where he would go out and he would just have his living room filled from floor to ceiling with boxes. He'd actually have to pull boxes out so he could see his TV through a window he made in a wall of boxes. It was just a lot more interpersonal back then. You know, you had to go in, you had to knock doors, really pound the pavement, get in contact with people who knew who to print boxes with and who could make these pieces. So just the internet has opened up so many doors for independent game design.
Yeah, that's one thing I've noticed lately is like, yeah, everybody knows who, you know, Milton Bradley and all that stuff is, but now you're seeing the actual designers become more of a, you know, everybody knows what a Steve Jackson game is. You know, the actual designers now are getting credit on the games. Before, when it was just a faceless corporation, and now you know who is making your game.
Yeah, there's been a huge trend toward that. They're seeing game designers almost like a director of a movie. That if you like one thing he's done, maybe you like something else that they've done, and it's really become more popular for that. Like you said, Steve Jackson's got his name on it. Gary Gygax was one of the big first ones, because a lot of it was you'd have these giant companies, they'd hire somebody to make the design, they'd get one check, and they'd never see anything out of it again. And so you see a lot more of finesse and knowledge out of the game designers. Hey, you know, I'd like to capitalize on this a little bit.
And I think probably with the internet and networking and everything else, probably that's gotten a little bit easier, you know, harder for a big corporation to, you know, take credit for something, especially if, you know, you're a Steve Jackson or somebody out there constantly turning over a really awesome product that,
like you said, really it's well. More like a movie now where you're getting the director, producer, writer credit or whatever with these games. And, you know, people start following the game designers like you would follow, the Kevin Smith movies, like, oh, these are, you know, these game, I've played this game, it's made by so-and-so, let's see what else he has designed. And sometimes it's completely different, but yeah, it kind of opens you up with like, all right, yeah, especially if people that are just getting into board gaming or the more serious board gaming, they're like, oh, I've played Munchkin, let's see what else is out there that's similar to this.
And then you find Cthulhu Munchkin and Zombie Munchkin and Munchkin Apocalypse.
All the Flux games.
Oh, yeah.
For someone who is, like said, because the question I get when people are like, when we're like, oh, we're doing a board game night, oh, are y'all playing, you know, Monopoly or whatever? And then I have to explain to them, no, these are games made for adults that are a little bit more, the rules are a little bit harder, it's a little bit more made for,
And probably the themes are a bit more risque, you know, especially when we break out stuff like Cards Against Humanity and things
Cards Against Humanity can turn bad quick.
Yeah.
Say people that are just getting into board gaming. I mean, where's a good place to start for, say, the casual gamer now that wants to get into the more modern era of games?
Okay, yeah. If you're looking for a little bit more meat, my first go-to game for that is Settlers of Catan. It is basically the gateway for a lot more complicated games than Monopoly. Not to say that they're hard. It's not hard to play. It's just your choices matter. You're not rolling a die and saying, oh, that's just what I get. But rather, you have a lot more specific.
You're mining resources. You're making, you know, treaties with people and stuff like that.
Yeah. And I think we'll talk on it when we talk about the Renaissance. But that's kind of one of the ones that also triggered that whole situation as well. And you're starting to see these games more often in Catan's in Target now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's one of the things is, you know, I mean, we were following Will Wheaton and Tabletop, and that was one of the things that kind of, you know, opens us up to, you know, a lot of the lesser games.
If you're just
at
your big box stores, you don't get to see a lot of these cool independent games. You have to really find a comic book store or a gaming store to get a hold of a lot of this stuff.
You know, we went to a lot of the books, but, you know, now Barnes & Noble, I mean, it's crazy. Yeah, Barnes & Noble has an excellent game selection. Game selections that they have now that I personally would have never even thought of.
But yeah, you're right. It's starting to fall into the, you know, like I said, Target's usually got a decent, you know, like I said, that's where I picked up Munchkin was, and I've got a few games from there. They've, like I said, they've really, really started, you're seeing them more and more in the mainstream stories. It's not just go to this one store on a back street somewhere to find games anymore.
Now, if you were to tell me 5 years ago Munchkin would be sitting on the shelf at Target, I would never have believed you, you know?
Yeah, I see that in, like, every comic book store. I mean, I've even been to, like, a few, like, music stores that have, like, a little gaming session, but there's always some kind of different
Munchkin
on the wall.
Munchkin or you see Flux or, you know, something of that nature.
So what's your favorite game you're currently playing?
Right now I'm liking
or do you have time to play games since you're busy making your own?
Well, it's a little bit of both. But I've been playing a lot of What's He Building in There. It's not a game a lot of people have heard of. I don't think
I've heard of that.
Just another independent game. Actually ran into the designer when I went up to Gen Con this year. And Gen Con is the largest board game convention in the U.S. In Indiana.
I would definitely like to go check that out someday because I've heard about it, but I've never seen it.
Oh yeah, it's 3 days of madness. but yeah, it's a worker placement game. Which is something where you have a limited number of guys that can do stuff for you every turn. You can choose where they go, and you're a mad scientist trying to build up your death machine and an escape route.
Escape route for your death machine.
Just another independent game. I met the guy, shook his hand, and he said, "Hey, you wanted the designer to sign the game for you?" I'm like, "Sure. Where is he?" "I'm him." "Oh,
that's awesome."
Because that's one thing also that I've really discovered when I've been designing board games is it's not a lot of people doing it. So it's
like I said, once you start looking at these games and stuff, you see a lot of the same names on the, like I said, these bigger or even the independent games, you see in the same people a lot.
Yeah, so it's a really small community, so it's real easy to get in and get in touch with a lot of people. I've been talking with designers of other bigger games, and it's interesting just how approachable and immediate you can get in touch with them.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question, is as you're approaching people for advice or direction and things like that. I mean, as a community, everybody pretty much willing to share ideas, or is it, hey, I'm going to hold on to what I've established? Or,
well, that's the community as a whole has been very open. They're open to ideas because they themselves work on feedback. Once again, they're prototypes, they're early versions, so they're used to a lot of back and forth. And there's this big myth about copyright in board games. You can't necessarily copyright a mechanic. You'll see that a lot because there'll be a lot of games that do a lot of the same things. Oh, you do this? Oh, it's the same as in Risk or blah, blah, blah. You can't necessarily copyright a mechanic, but you can copyright copyright specific parts of it. It's
like the artwork and stuff like that.
Right.
Or you have titles.
And the way it all kind of interconnects. Like Wizards of the Coast actually has a copyright on tapping. The phrase tapping. But then other games will be like, you expend the unit, turn the card into an orientation differently. So there's not as much secrecy as you might think, because there's not as much that you can necessarily steal because it's already out in the open anyway.
Definitely.
I mean, there's so much more time spent trying to get a mechanic, make it work, test it, play test it, and having ideas flesh out your own rather than steal somebody else's. So there's been very little of that. And again, with it being such a small community, if one person steals from you, everybody knows it. So it's a so it's a sort of an immediate blacklist on that one.
Did I just read this last week in this other game? Well, you mentioned playtesting. That's probably something most people don't know a whole lot about. Say you've got your original idea. What are you looking at when you're doing the playtesting? What says this works or doesn't work for you?
Well, it depends on the style of game, but generally I'd like to see player interaction. I like to see people enjoying themselves. It really should be the number one thing. They're having fun, but good player interaction, make sure that somebody's just not sitting there for 10 minutes waiting on somebody else to do something or go through this big, long, convoluted. I want to make sure people understand what they're doing, why they're doing it, like I said, it all comes down to fun is really the key. There'll be pieces where it's like, is that really necessary? I did this for 5 minutes and it changed the game. Not at all. So I want also the choices to be meaningful.
Yeah, not just a time waster, busy work. There's a point to whatever you're doing in the game.
Right. It feels like players are actually having an impact rather than, the dice tell me what to do, so I'm just a passive player at this point. So I want them to have those choices.
Yeah, I mean, is it like luck versus skill? How much of a board game is blind luck of the dice, and how much of it is, you've got to be good at what you're doing to play the game?
Right. Oh, you've got games all the way from Candyland. That's 100% luck. You draw a card and you move there.
Some chutes and ladders.
I mean, when you're playing 100% luck, that's not really a game. The game's playing you. You're just going through the motions. And then you have games like chess, which is what's called a perfect information game. There's no randomness. There's nothing secret. But most people tend to prefer something in the middle. One's just too wild. One's too dry. So having a little bit of a randomness in there adds surprise, adds kind of this this element of tension. You know, will this show up this way or not? But at the end of the day, most people want their choices to matter than a random luck.
Yeah, I mean, because I've been playing a lot. Have you played any of the X-Wing tabletop game yet?
I've seen it played. I want to get into it so bad.
Like I said, you only need like four or five ships to play, but I've bought every ship. So I have enough for like multiple armies. So anytime you want to try it, I'll bring my set over. But it reminds me of chess because you have to, it's not like, you know, Warhammer is turn-based. Like I'll do all my movements and then you'll do your movements. But next one you do it at the same time. Mm-hmm. So you got to kind of guess what they're going to do. And like I said, it has that element of skill where you got to try to plan your moves, but then when you roll the dice to shoot your weapons or defend, you can still get fucked by the dice. So it still has that. You can play perfectly and get the guy in your sights, and then you miss when you roll. So that having that skill base plus there's still that element of luck that can screw you in the end.
Well, I mean, and there's also the fact of I can recall you get lucky a couple and games survive. Where you and I have played after having a few beers, and you got the little will that dictates your movement that you select, and it's like, oh crap, I just completely moved in the opposite direction I was intended to or something. So
yeah, player error is also
a lot of room for player error.
So as a developer, what is harder, a full board based game or a card game or a story based game? What do you think is more difficult for the design aspect?
Generally, I find story-based games to be very difficult, just because it's hard to find something that appeals to a lot of different people. You know, if you're playing card games, I tend to find are the easiest. There's not a lot of components. You can balance it. You can certainly have complexity, but that's just those fewer pieces involved. Having something that has an interesting story, something that would be believable without necessarily being cheesy, unless that's what you're going for. But having pieces pulled together at that point, you're making a game. Plus, you're also making lore and everything else, and that just it just compiles.
So, is it usually the same people developing, the mechanics of the game and then the storyline, or would you have like a team of folks kind of working on character and mechanic development, and then maybe a separate set of people, actually tying the storyline and coming up with that lore aspect of things?
You'll see that in like larger production groups. Jason Bowman, who does the Pathfinder, who heads up the Pathfinder group, he's still very hands-on as far as the mechanics, but he has a lot of lore people with him. But as far as smaller productions like mine, it's mostly me, and then I've got a couple guys that I work pretty closely with. But generally, in sections like mine, it's harder to really do that. But you'll see that in larger productions. You know, have an art team, a story team, mechanics team, and all kind of work in concert with each other.
But I guess being the point person and seeing it from start to finish, I mean, ultimately you get to dictate. And I guess at the end of the day, it's also too knowing that, hey, that's actually my thoughts and, my intelligence and everything else to make the game flow in its entirety. So.
Oh, yeah. Project management comes into it a lot. Yeah. Even on my smaller ones, I'll have, hey, you do some playtesting with your group of friends down in Atlanta or whatever. I'll do some tweaks up here with these people. If you'd read over my rules. And so even a small production like mine, I still have a lot of moving pieces, and so just having project and time management really comes into play there.
Yeah, I think that's a lot of things, that one of the things I don't necessarily think about when, talking about board games and everything is that whole development, project management phase of things.
Yeah, somebody had to write this, this complex or simple game mechanic they were using, and that's something that most people don't really think about. You just pull it off the shelf and start playing.
I think that's one of the reasons that I kind of stuck with Magic the Gathering throughout the years and stuff is there's so many different options as far as the strategy as to how you want to play the game, and the fact that it's you developing the deck, but knowing that somebody spent the time to develop all those possible combinations and everything, it's I have a certain appreciation for it.
And as you were saying, the it's, you know, especially for new people, I find that card-based games like Munchkin or Flux, so like that, are a little bit simpler to get new players involved.
I mean, it's easier, you know, for somebody that's not going to play, you know, this particular game, you know, multiple times. Like, you know, when we do Cards Against Humanity, we run through the rules in four minutes.
It's fairly simple.
And, you know, you can figure it as you go, and if you, you know, screw up something, then, you know, it's not a make or break. And
yeah, some of these, like I said, these card-based games are kind of like the infection vector to get people that haven't, you know, done board games and then move them on to the more complex, like, you know, Elder Signs or some of these more detailed board games.
Well, I mean, there's a lot, you know, I mean, some of the games that I've purchased, I mean, they're so complex in the rules and everything else that, I mean, to get a game going, I mean, we spend 2 hours and set up and familiarizing ourselves with the rules. Yeah. And, you know, unless you're serious about games, most folks just aren't, you know, they want to show up, play a game, have some food or drinks or something, and, you know, call it a night.
But, and your storytelling games, too. Those things can get, yeah, because I've tried to play Gloom with my brothers, and they're not the most creative. You're having to play a game where you have to tell a story on your characters.
Yeah, it's like coaching the people you're playing against.
Yeah, if you don't have that creative brain or... That, you know, sometimes it's hard to play those story-based games like that.
Yeah, and that's why all those different kinds of games are out there. You know, not everybody that plays Cranium will want to play 8 hours of Arkham Horror.
Yeah, there's definitely like I said, now that it's more of a niche, whatever that word is, I can't pronounce at the moment.
Niche.
I've had too many monsters today, people. This is my third recording session. But
there's something for everybody. Literally running around the freaking podcast table here just from mic to mic, and... You know, he's just making it appear that he's stationary because he's moving so fast.
I just thought all y'all were hallucination that I wasn't even here at this point.
I don't know, dude. You are wearing camouflage. I mean, all I see is a head. So
very, very sneaky. That's one thing I lost my train of thought there. But the benefit of, you know, we start getting into probably the Renaissance period of gaming now. Like I said, there's a huge niche market where people can find, there's something for everyone out there, but Will Wheaton's tabletop YouTube show, that's kind of what I got back into games was from watching that, and that makes it so much easier when we've collected a lot of the games he does. If we're going to have a game night and someone isn't familiar, instead of spending 30 minutes to an hour explaining the rules of the game, I can just send him a link, say, hey, here's the episode of tabletop.
Yeah, I mean, you get a rundown of the rules, game. You get to see the game in action, and, you know,
it's
people
a lot easier
ultimately,
having him explain it to somebody, you know, than us, you know, spending an hour trying to talk people through the game.
I think it's good, too, because people get an opportunity to see if it's something they're actually going to like. I mean, you know, if you talk about a game like Settlers of Catan or something along that nature, you know, people would hear the title and say, I'm not interested, you know. Sounds like Farmville or something you would play on Facebook, but no, it's not that at all.
Right.
There's a Star Trek version. There's a bunch of different versions of Settlers.
Oh, yeah. It's sort of becoming the modern Monopoly. It has very similar core concepts. So you have land, and you are rolling dice to some extent, but you're using it to develop your properties. You're trading between players. So a lot of those core concepts are still there, but you're doing it in a way where it's not as random and dependent upon where you happen to land. It really develops based on player choice. And that was really the breaking point for modern board games was the so-called German board games revolution. Settlers of Catan, most people don't realize this, came out in 1995. It just didn't come over here until, you know, a little more recently.
Some of these games that we're seeing now have been around for a while. It's just, you know, for some reason now everything's, you know, blowing up and becoming more popular. Like I said, you're seeing it in mainstream stores and stuff.
Yeah. And so after Catan hit, it changed a lot of the ways people were looking at board games and board game design. And you had a lot of other ones come right after it. Ticket to Ride, another big one, also in Target now.
Yeah. There's like several versions of that now. There's like three or four different remakes, you know, Europe, Asia, America.
Right. Whatever continent you want.
Yeah.
And then you had games like Puerto Rico, where it's a little bit meatier, but also in the same vein. And it just showed people that, hey, there is more to board games than what we saw in the past, you know, 20 years with the 80s plastic crap revolution and everything else.
Dude, don't knock my army, man.
I mean, when someone designed battle shots for the battleship, yeah, that brought it to the next level. You sunk my battleship, and I just did 5 shots. Mm. That's
Or you start getting into the what is it? Was it Dude, Where's My Car? Where they play battleships? What movie was that one?
No, that's Harold and Kumar.
Yeah, Harold and Kumar. Yeah. You sunk my battleship.
Oh God. Yeah, I'd be. So, what do you think it is that this? Because we spent years and years going into the. Like video games and stuff, right. And which was more of a isolationist time in gaming, where even if you were playing on the internet with people, they weren't necessarily there with you. You were playing against a faceless crowd. What do you think it is that has brought us back to this more communal social revolution of bringing board games back to the mainstream?
Well, there are a few key kind of triggers for that. One, we had the recession, and I actually saw a dip in video game sales, but you saw an increase in board game sales, and a lot of people attribute that to the fact that board games are a better value.
Yeah,
you spend $40 on a board game, you and a couple buddies play a couple times, you're already getting 10-20 hours on it. You get a video game, you beat the story mode in 50 minutes, and you spent $50 on it.
It's good for maybe one or two playthroughs.
Like multiplayer aspect and stuff. I mean, unfortunately... Yeah.
It eventually gets old, but with a board game, it's different every time a new group of people sits down with it. I mean, it has that replayability factor that you don't really get with video games.
And I think that's one of the things, is no two people will probably play the same game the same way. Same way, there's different strengths and weaknesses in each individual. So, I think that adds a whole dynamic. I mean, that's one of the big reasons I play poker. It's not so much because I enjoyed the way the cards fall. It's I enjoy playing that opponent across from me or beside me. And, there's a whole psychological aspect of things that really appeals to me.
Yeah. And also, if you're looking at just skill cap in general, two people, if somebody's a little slower or whatever, they can still play a game just fine. If you're playing Counter-Strike and you miss a headshot and you have a team of 13-year-olds calling you an asshat afterwards,
Yeah, you don't see that much as board games. You tell somebody an asshat in a board game, you're liable to get punched
because
they're right across the table from you.
Plus, you also
So are you condoning punching a 13-year-old for calling you an asshat?
Some of them deserve it, man.
You
gotta keep your pimp hand strong. That's all I'm saying.
That is true.
And here we are with no powder at the table.
But you also have sort of the tactile aspect of board games. Like you touched on earlier, people love rolling dice. People love picking up and fiddling and touching things with their hands.
I mean, there's something tangible there. So,
exactly.
I mean, that's...
You can play an online version of a board game, but it just... Oh, the computer cheated me because it gave me these cards,
Damn it, the lag. Stupid Comcast.
Yeah. and just that social aspect, like we said, just you know the person across from you, or you're getting to know them by playing it. It's just that whole social aspect. If you know the person, then you might have an idea of what they're doing and why they're doing it. So it just adds additional dimensions you just can't get from, say, an online sort of game.
And like I said, we could spend $100 going out to a club, for a night, but 30, 40, even like the, I think most expensive I played is like $50 for a board game. That's something you can reuse. I mean, it over and over again, many, many times. So it's definitely economic factor.
Beer on it or something. I mean,
even then you just, it's make sure it's that good, quality stuff. Just wipe it off quickly. You're good to go.
Buy replacement parts.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they also have good resaleability, too. I mean, unless you go for like a $5 copy of Monopoly at a yard sale. Yeah. Most of the time, if you're going online to eBay, board games still actually keep their value or increase in value.
I was trying to, when I found my old HeroQuest, it was kind of in rough shape. And I was just looking online trying to find maybe some of the old expansion packs. And stuff like $100, man. Board games have become collectible now. I mean, especially some of the big ones that aren't even in like print anymore. I mean, they're still going pretty high dollar if they're in good shape on eBay and whatever.
Yeah, so a copy of Fireball Island going for like $300.
Holy shit. That better come with like some island dancing girls for that price. That's...
That was still from that crappy 80s like roll and move thing, but it was unique enough and people have the nostalgia, so And it wasn't a bad game. I actually had it.
So what do you think it is? What is, has driven this key from moving away from the family-oriented games to the more, like I said, more adult, complicated games that we've seeing in the modern era?
Well, again, it comes back to meaningful choices. You know, as games get more strategic and more in depth, then you see people are saying, "Hey, this is a real mental exercise," and so it naturally draws people who want to think and challenge themselves a little bit more, and so it naturally kind of leads to that. Actually, a lot of people don't know this, but wargaming, when you're talking about miniatures, Warhammer, that sort of stuff, H.G. Wells back in like 1920. Triggered a lot of this. He played with little soldiers playing old colonial battles and whatnot, and wrote rule sets for them. And that, and so it's always been about adults playing. It's just you had a lot of periods where a lot of kid friendly stuff sort of saturated the market. Once again, the 80s plastic crap revolution. but then as people saw
the plastic crap, it describes the 80s perfectly. There's so much of that in every thing of the 80s.
Dude, my Ninja Turtles weren't crap.
But I bet the board game was.
Probably was, yeah.
Video game, next to impossible.
Oh. That's the thing, too, that I've noticed with a lot of the older family games. Like, with the modern stuff, it may be more complicated, but there's... I mean, they even have it on the box. This is probably a 1 to 2 hour game, a 20 to 30 minute game, where, say, Monopoly, you could play that shit for hours and not have a winner. Like I can't play Monopoly anymore. I will open a vein if I have to sit there for 5 hours playing Monopoly. But you know, like I said, it's with board games, you know, I said, you know, in 5 hours, you know, in the modern era, you can knock out five or six different games that are like that one drudging on game.
Right. And another point to modern games is you'll see a lot less player elimination. You know, you play Monopoly, you get knocked out, and oh crap, I'm just gonna sit here in the corner while everybody finishes. Most modern games don't have that anymore.
Yeah, there's a lot of
of game that comes out now, and it's the group
you're
of
playing against the board instead
the board
of
or whatever.
Like Pandemic was one we've played recently. Yeah. That's like you're all playing against the board or the disease. And what's the zombie game we played where basically you're playing as a group? Like somebody controls the zombies, but then everybody else controls the
fun
people.
One, yeah.
Like I said, you see a lot of those now that it's not just about, destroying your friends. You're all playing as a community, which you really didn't see that mechanic in some of the older family-style games.
And in fact, the first time I've seen it now, I saw Resistance yesterday. And that's been a game that I really wanted to play where, you got a group of friends, but one of them's the mole. So
yeah, I've been wanting to play that game, but we've had a hard time getting enough people together at the same time. Because you need, like five players for that one. It's like... we can barely get four together at once.
Yeah, just having people on teams, there's going to be no elimination. Or there's one game that I saw, I can't remember the name of it, but if you're playing as against zombies, but a person can turn and become the zombie player. Now they're on the other side. So even if there's a...
I wonder if that's Zombicide. I think...
I've keep seeing it at the store.
Yeah, I mean, it's one that's been on my list to get, but, I mean, it's also one that I can't find it with less than a $90 price tag.
Yeah, that one's got a lot of miniatures, too. Yeah. That's the only thing with Warhammer. Warhammer is fun, but you've got to build the models. It's a whole event because you got to build and paint the models and stuff. That's why I kind of like X-Wing. I call it Warhammer for lazy people. Everything's pre-painted and pre-assembled. You don't have to build anything. Take it out of the box and start playing.
After you put everything on the little stands.
Oh, yeah, because I spent hours and hours building those freaking Warhammer armies and then hardly ever played with them.
And so many of these board games are just so appealing because, hey, you do get a rich strategic experience out of a box. You don't have to go through all that extra. Of course, now if you want to go into the further stuff, the Warhammers and the Orcs and all that.
If you have time and money, it's fun, but I usually have neither. So I need my games to be a little bit simpler.
I need budget friendly and time friendly and we're loser friendly too.
Yeah, we need a cigar sponsor and a board game sponsor for the podcast. So
also, another thing that really led to the proliferation of board games was the internet. Because now you're seeing Settlers of Catan, you had Ticket to Ride. These were all games developed in Germany and Europe, where board games are huge and have been huge for years. So it's just a cultural thing. And then all of a sudden, much more people were getting aware of these sort of games and that they're out there. You can order them online instead of having to go through some import guy. So the games were much more readily available, and it sort of flattened out the curve for a lot of things. You'll see that in the music industry. You know, yeah. iTunes, hey, people aren't as tied to record labels as they used to be. You can do independent releases.
A lot more indie artists and stuff like that emerging and actually being able to, you know, make names for themselves and
you're getting
their comeuppance.
Yeah, I mean, in the internet era, it's a whole lot easier to find people to play these games. You know, before it was just like, oh, you and your friends play this game, but yeah, I can go on, you know, Facebook and find the Settlers of Catan group, and you can find local games. You also see a lot more of gaming places, like, yeah, most comic book stores now have like a big gaming area in the back, and where people can come, you know, even if you're not buying anything, you can come and play, you know, play your games. Or, you know, like I said, there's even like full bars and stuff now that have gaming nights that, you know, you can play, you know, bring your board games and hang out and play.
I mean, locally, you know, that trip that we did to Flashback Games, I forgot that playing a physical stand-up arcade game was a workout.
You're like, getting too old for this shit, Riggs.
Yeah. Like, all right, somebody, I need a freaking hyperventilator or something over here, because button pressure and joystick and.
I have never ventured down into the gaming dungeon at Dragon Con until this year, because there was like an area where people went and gamed, and I kind of ventured down there to see if anybody was playing, you know, any of the games that I've been playing lately or wanted to play. And that was a giant room, and it was full of people like 24 hours a day. So it's definitely exploded. One of the guys that was rooming with me, because they keep it in the dungeon of the Hyatt.
Oh yeah,
Hilton. Yeah, Hilton. Yeah. So it's like there's no windows down there. There's no clocks on the wall. He's like, yeah, dude, I went over there to play like a quick game of Magic, and I noticed it was like 8 hours later. I've like missed the whole day. He just kind of sucks you in down there.
I came out from playing Magic, and all of a sudden the parties have all started.
Yeah. Sounds like a win to me.
Yeah, it was. Like I said, that was kind of surprising, because I'd never gone over there and hung out in that area. And like I said, it was just a giant, and there was so many different games. I mean, there was even, I seen one, I have no idea what it is, but it was a MechWarrior game. But instead of like the little like Warhammer miniatures, these things were a good like foot tall. I mean, it was like giant. Oh, it was like, wow, it's like a giant version of a tabletop game. And they had a whole like city built out there that they were playing this MechWarrior game in. So I mean, there is literally something for everyone. Whether it's you want to play a quick 5 minute game of Flux or whatever, or you want to spend hours, you know, battling the galaxy and, you know, some giant tabletop game.
I'll say Flux is a dangerous game, because I've had 5 minute games and I've had like hour and a half long games. I mean, it just really all depends on how the cards are falling.
Or it depends on how bad your buddies want to screw you over. Yeah. You find that in Munchkin too. Like, you can be helpful or you just, you know, screw your buddy type of game.
I was going to win and now I'm not. Thanks.
Sometimes it's fun to be the asshole. So, as we're kind of winding it down here, is there any final thoughts on, or let me ask something we hadn't touched on, kids today, I mean, that want to become a game designer, where do they start? Like, what's your recommendation of someone who is interested in a career in gaming? Like, you know, how do you progress in that? How do you get started in that?
Making a prototype is as easy as picking up a Sharpie marker and a piece of paper. But there's tons of online resources. There's a website called Board Game Geek that tells you a lot about current board games, current board game trends. There was a website I used called The Game Crafter, a little shout out there, where you can buy pieces. You can have boards printed for you. And that's how I actually did a lot of my early prototyping and development. At that point, just get a bunch of friends to play. You know, you may not ever sell it, but if you and your friends had fun with something that you put together, that's going to be some of the best time.
I mean, I would call that a win.
Oh, yeah.
Just a personal reward from that, you know, can make it worthwhile. I don't know, your thing with a Sharpie, that would be dangerous for me, because I think I'd need something that would... I'm either going to need lots of white out, or I need something with an eraser.
even if it's something that you don't get ultimately published, I mean, it's something for you and your friends to play at some point. So, yeah. I mean, there's no, you know, if you build something, there's no failing at it. I mean, it's just, you know, how successful is it going to be? But
I think
if you're having fun with it, it's success to me. Yeah,
exactly.
I mean, it's like our podcast or cosplay or anything else. I mean,
as long as it makes you happy freaking do it. It's you ain't got to be a millionaire off of it. You know, as long as you're enjoying what you're doing, you have at it.
Or even something as simple, if you have a game you don't like, make new rules for it. That's a great jumping off point, because you've already kind of have an idea how it works, but hey, I hate this part. Change it. Mix it up around. You know, at that point, you may end up with a new game at the end.
My game idea is Taser Battleship.
Taser Battleship.
Yeah, like every time
I've been hit.
Every time you lose a piece, somebody gets shot.
I'm seizing. I think I just urinated.
I think I might forfeit before I start.
All right, so I think you mentioned a little bit before, but you know, as we're working our way out of here, go ahead and plug your game. So what can they pick up and support your company there?
Okay, well, we're on Facebook, Enigma Nexus, also enigmanexus.com. We have plenty of games out there for sale, so it's a little something for everybody. And we're actually looking to kickstart something hopefully in February or so. So we're releasing new games all the time. And if it looks like something you'd like, please check us out, or at least give us a like.
And we'll put links, all that stuff, in the show notes, so you can check out some of their games and play some stuff. So any final thoughts on gaming, Brad?
I mean, my final thoughts are, folks, you know, like we touched on, if you're interested in getting development, go out, do what makes you happy. You know, like I said, you don't have to become a millionaire or anything, just as long as you can take something away from it, have pride and appreciation, knowing that, hey, you helped create something that other people enjoyed. I mean, I'm just kind of curious about where everything goes in the future. I mean, we've seen so many spinoffs and everything else that, you know, I mean, this whole resurging of people wanting to get together and actually game and everything else. I mean, dude, I personally feel like, being in an IT world, we all spend too much time behind computer screens and stuff of that nature.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, always a great excuse to get some friends together, have a good quality time, and you know what? Rock and roll. I mean,
Any final things there, Mike?
With the internet being what it is, it's really opened up the world to a lot of board game players and designers, with things like Kickstarter, you know, the Game Crafter, and just the forums to be able to discuss and talk about board games. I think it will continue seeing the popularity just keep strong as people go out and discover that there are board games catered toward what they really enjoy, and so there really is something for everybody, as long as people want to look.
Sweet. All right, well, thanks for being our guest here in the Nerd Cave this week, and we're gonna get out of here and play some games. So right. we'll be right back with some beer 30.
Stay tuned.
See you,
folks.
Better get back up here. This is a song about a guy you might remember from high school. Or you might be this guy from high school. I don't know. My little harmonica. I got my 12-sided die, and I'm ready to roll with a wizard and my goblin crew. My friends are coming over to my mom's basement, bringing Funyuns and the Mountain Dew. I got a big broadsword made out of cardboard, and that stereo's a pumping Zeppelin. It's that time of the night, we turn on the black light, let the dungeons and the dragons begin. It's D&D, fighting with the legends of yore. It's D&D. Never kissed a lady before. Nope. Woo! Now the Lord of the Rings, the dark crystal and things, we use these as a reference tool. And when we put on our cloaks and tell warlock jokes, we're the coolest kids at the school. No, we're not. I know.
Hey man, it's almost that time.
What time is it?
Beer 30.
The Boozehounds return.
And welcome back to Beer 30. Today we're trying another Georgia brew, Terrapin Side Project number 23, Guano Loco. And for y'all that don't speak Spanish, that translates into batshit crazy.
Yeah, I gotta say, man, this is it's a fiesta in a glass. I mean, I'm ready. I mean, all we need is to break out some mariachi music and everything, and you know, get me some freaking nachos or carne asada or something, and let's throw down.
It is a chili pepper brownie ale instead of, you know, a brown ale style with just a little bit of like peppery to it.
Yeah, using the ancho chili, so, you know, former produce experience. Your anchos, they're a subtle heat, you know. You're not going to get into light your ass on fire with, like, some jalapenos or habaneros or something. But, I mean, it definitely has a bit of a lingering heat on the back end.
Yeah, it's a described as a piñata, like a piñata bursting at the seams. Explodes with a flavor from a myriad of directions. Chocolatey sweetness melds brilliantly with spicy heat to make the beer a fiesta in your glass. Yeah, it's, this, like I said, it's part of their yearly release. This is the 2014 edition, so you can definitely find it and a lot of their some of their older editions. Like I said, especially like the last few side projects, you have no shouldn't have any problem finding at your local craft beer store.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this beer here, I think when we originally poured it, we tried to basically flash cool the beer, so we left it in the freezer for about half an hour or so, and we got a little bit below where it should be at.
Yeah, the recommended serving temperature is 50 to 55 degrees.
And pint glass here, folks, for the glassware. And I'm just looking at some of the food pairings here, and you know, Terrapin Site, they're recommending pulled pork carnitas, tacos served with a spicy slaw or fresh guacamole on the side, or some Spanish rice with onions, garlic, and just a touch of cinnamon. So, I mean, we're just kind of keeping going with the
this will be good with your Mexican night.
Yeah, I'm dude, break out the grandpa's guitars. I'll put on a sombrero. I mean,
it's all good.
Yeah, we'll play some Viva Pinata since that's what Xbox Live gave me free at the beginning of the month.
Viva Pinatas, oh my God. Alcohol's 8.6%, so this is, you know, one of your more stout, high-gravity beers. So you have a couple of these, you will be dancing around the sombrero. And
and it'll be fun. All of your friends will say, what's with this guy? He's acting batshit crazy, and it could be because he's drinking batshit crazy beer.
Yeah, it's a lot of... A lot of hops, malts. I say two-row pale victory special roast hops and our malts and some other stuff. IBU is 35, so it's a little bitter, but not like super bitter as some of your IPAs. Yeah, brown ales are definitely a little bit smoother than your IPA variety.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this thing is you know, I mean, to be what it is actually very smooth. I was surprised that. You know, you don't really get a whole lot of head, you know, on the pour with this beer. But, I mean, the overall taste, now that it's starting to warm up a little bit, I'm starting to pick up on some chocolate hints in there as well. So that's kind of balancing out the heat. I mean, it's...
Just because it says, you know, peppery, it's not, like, overpowering. I've had a few other beers that have added some pepper to it. And, yeah, so you may get a little bit of an afterburn, but it's not... An overpowering flavor.
No, it's not over the top. I mean, it's definitely not like you've bit into a jalapeno or anything of that nature. It's
jalapeno, man.
Dude, I have nightmares about jalapenos now after our last nacho trip to Hooters. Okay, I mean that was
wuss.
Dude, I saw a tear roll down your cheek. I don't want to hear it.
It was a single man tear.
No, you didn't have on the kilt, so you can't even use that line.
No, you have to watch the 200th episode of Supernatural. They went as a musical, and one of the songs in there is called A Single Man Tear. It's freaking hysterical.
I'll have to give that a listen.
Oh, yeah. They investigate a school who's doing the musical version of Supernatural. And, yeah, it's all these, like, high school kids singing about Supernatural. It's messed up, dude.
You know what? I'm surprised with the, you know...
It is Guano Loco.
With the, you know... Chili flavor that I pick up on and the chocolate and stuff, the aroma does not give that at all. I mean, if you were to, you know, pour this beer to somebody unbeknownst and, you know, served it to them in a glass, I mean, it looks just like your traditional brown style ale. You know, a little bit of a reddish copper to almost a cloudy brown on this one. Then again, it could be all the smoke.
Everything's cloudy here in the Nerd Cave.
That's how we do it, folks. We do it big. So,
so what are you giving this one on our official Untappd rating?
For me, this one is about a 3.5. You know, not my favorite, although I would be curious to try some of the food pairings with this beer. And, you know, the cigar that we're smoking has got a little bit of a peppery taste, too. So for me, it's, you know, both worlds are kind of coming together. I want something to kind of offset it a little bit. But
yeah, I'd definitely try some of these pulled pork tacos. That sounds good on its own, but I would definitely want to have this beer again with some of these food pairings. And yeah, I give it around a 3.5 myself, and that's out of 5, folks. So that's, like I said, a mid-level rating for us. It's, like I said, it's definitely one I would try again.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, once again, if you're here in the Atlanta market, I mean, it's coming from Terrapin, Athens, Georgia. So, I mean, it's local, and anything I can do to support the local, you know, beer scene, I'm all about it.
Yeah. Drink local, listen to local music. Yeah, we can't smoke local because everything's from another country. But otherwise, support your local breweries, folks.
Yep. And any final thoughts?
That's good beer.
All right.
And we'll be back with some science.
Stay tuned.
Yes, science.
And we're back with some science, where we drop knowledge like B-52s drop bombs.
Holy crap, you didn't ask if I was ready to get educated or anything this time. I must be on my way to being a genius at this point.
I just gave up because, like I said, you're never ready for knowledge.
Aww.
I'm just like, just give up on it. Well, since this is our gaming episode, our first science segment is going to be, they've done a new study on whether violent video games make violent people.
Yeah, I'm curious to see how this pans out. I mean, you know, I got to say, if you put me in front of a video game and, I mean, let's just throw it out there, you know, games like Ninja Gaiden and stuff like that are next to impossible or, you know, freaking Mega Man or something, my blood pressure is boiling at that point. Yeah. But, you know, I'm probably going to answer, you know, some survey questions and stuff pretty negatively, but am I going to go shoot up a place? Yeah, absolutely. I mean, not.
I've played a lot of Grand Theft Auto, but I've never, you know, robbed a hooker. And anybody who grew up in, like, you know, in the early 90s and stuff, when this became a big deal that, oh, video games causes kids to be violent, that was when we got the ESRB ratings and stuff on video games. And before that, you never saw the ratings on TV shows. You always saw them on movies and stuff. But now everything's got a, you know, TV-14.
Yeah, I mean, I just think this kind of goes along with the whole political correctness that you're seeing, you know, and the entire, yeah, you know, movement of the United States. I mean, it's almost going, I mean, maybe a little bit off topic, but it kind of reminds me of, like, your freaking, you know, propaganda films like Reefer Madness and things.
I want to see Reefer Madness. That's going to be an awesome movie.
I'm working on directing it.
Nice.
Casting call is now open, folks.
Yeah. Originally, some of these earlier studies that said that, oh, kid, this makes kids violent, it was really the results weren't great. I mean, there were some that were positive, some that were negative, some that just kind of, you know, showed no correlation, because the way they did it was purely experimental. They would let people play violent video games, and then they would take a survey to say if they're more aggressive or not, which that really doesn't translate outside the lab to the
real world. I wonder how many people, you know, would – I mean, I've been on plenty of forums and, you know, comment sections and stuff like that. I mean, you got some people that are just going to troll no matter what.
And even, like I said, Grand Theft Auto or Call of Duty or something like that, you know, sure, I get fired up after I've played a violent game or watched a violent movie, but – you know, I smoke a cigar, have a beer, go to bed. Yeah, I don't go out and, like, you know, I'm going to commit crimes now because it was fun, you know, killing people in Grand Theft Auto. Well, the Journal of Communication just released a study by Christopher J. Ferguson, which he did a more in-depth study. And what he did, instead of doing the experimental method that was done before, was to track data. Basically, from, like, 96 till now, like a 15-year segment, he looked at how violent video games were, that were, you know, rated video games on their violent content, and how much was entering the market during that 15-year period. And then he compared it to the uniform crime data that the FBI collects of, you know, youth crimes from 12 to 17, and to see if there was a correlation between the violence of the video games and the violence in youth culture. And his results were, there is a correlation, but it's reversed. As video games have gotten more violence, crime has actually gone down.
Yeah, I mean, I could see that. I mean, you got a lot more outreach and things like that. I mean, let's face it, you know, most crimes are committed, one, either because of a mental health issue, or two, just because of, you know, circumstantial, you know, lifestyles, or, you know, I would say more to do with upbringing and culture more so than I would, you know, trying to say, oh, well, I played Grand Theft Auto. The title's Grand Theft Auto. Therefore, I felt compelled to steal a car.
Well, no. That, and too, also, I think, like, I studied criminology in college, and there's a lot of studies that equate crime to just there's no other options in that environment. And like I said, where there's, you know, not a whole lot of things for youths to do other than commit crimes. You know, there's no, you know, social.
Dude, what are you talking about? When I was a kid, I kicked the can down the dirt road all by my lonesome. I mean,
but yeah, you know, a lot of these, you know, high crime areas are lower socioeconomic areas that there's not a lot of other things for people to do. And I think these violent video games, you know, if you're at home playing Call of Duty for 12 hours a day, you're not on the streets committing crimes. So I think these, as video games have gotten more popular, it's given people
almost
stuff to do
like
other than
an outlet in itself.
Yeah, you know, like the old saying, you know, idle hands are the devil's playground. You know, if you don't have anything else to do, you're going to get into shit. And since people have video games now, that they're not out there getting into stuff as much.
Yeah, I think that's a very good correlation. I mean, so much of this to me just seems like that, I mean, I would say there's just naturally bad people.
Yeah.
And people, I guess, just automatically want to assume the positive intent that, oh, there's nobody out there that could just be, you know, pure evil or something along those lines.
There's
got to
be a cause, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we're trying to, you know, rational, you know, justify everything. It just doesn't make sense.
And I think another thing, too, to back up this data of his that crime is going down as video game violence is going up is like we talked about when we talked about non-drinkers not living as long, they're more stressed out or whatever. I think, you know, like I said, there's days where I'm stressed out and I'd like to punch somebody in the face, but if I go home and play some Call of Duty for a couple hours and just blast people online, calms me down, you know. It gives a productive way to release my aggression.
No, I mean, you're able to, you know, translate that physical anger or whatever and take it out on a game and, you know, run around and just, you know, or you become like me and you play some impossibly hard game and it makes you even more frustrated, so you just go and have a cigar. Give up.
Well, in other science news this week, I think it was last Wednesday, you know, I always badmouth robots are going to be in the, you know, our destruction, but sometimes robots do good stuff. And we have recently landed a, I don't know what you call it, satellite, rover, whatever, on a comet. Comet 67P, which also has some big Russian name that I can't pronounce. But yeah, this week we actually landed a rover on a comet.
Yeah, I mean, let's just put this thing in perspective. This thing is moving at 34,000 miles per hour.
41,000 is what? The one. I mean, that's like, you know, trying to land something in space purely by remote control or computer program, whatever. That's like an impossible feat to me. I'm like, there's no, I mean, it's hard enough to land a jet on an aircraft carrier, and it's, you know, relatively stationary in the sea. I mean, that's insane to me to be able to drop something on a comet like that.
Jeez, it's just crazy. I mean, 311 million miles from Earth. I mean, if we got any 311 fans out there, I mean, that's great marketing.
The lander is named Philae, and it was part of the Rosetta was its mothership. So Rosetta gets it there, and then this rover, you know, lands on the comet, and hopefully, if it all works out right, we'll come back to Earth and bring us. It's already transmitting a bunch of data, but they also want it to be able to take soil samples or, you know, actually find out what comets are made
of. I mean, this doesn't come without, you know, some of its perils. I mean, we're hearing, you know, now that some of the harpoons and stuff designed to anchor, you know, the shuttle to the comet haven't quite deployed and things.
Yeah, but apparently it bounced on impact, so it didn't land exactly where we wanted it to land, so it kind of landed in a shadow of a cliff, so it's not able to deploy its solar panels because it's in the shade, so we're going to be dependent on battery life, so it may not last as long as they originally intended, and with it not being anchored to the comet, it might be too hard to drill in and get, you know, the samples we're looking for. But this is like a huge step. I mean, this nothing like this ever been done before. And unfortunately, while, you know, our NASA is not really doing a whole lot right now, this was the European Space Agency, and the lead controller was Jean-Pierre Bibring, or B-I-B-R-B-R-I-N-G.
Come on, dude, you're knocking me from my Spanish accents. Come on, let's...
This is French, dude. Like I said, I took Spanish. I can't pronounce French. But did
I
you
mean, just hold your nose and use a very nostril voice.
Did you see this
voice?
Guy on the video of the landing? I want to hang out with this dude because he's wearing a shirt that has like all these like half naked anime women on it.
Did you hear
stuff.
The flack he's getting over that too? Like he actually had to come out and do a press release and apologize for his offensive shirt.
I mean,
and stuff.
We've got Mohawk Man at the Jet Propulsion Labs that did the whole Mars rover thing. I'm like, these guys are like the rock stars of their industry. I mean, if the dude can land on a comet, he can wear whatever he wants. In my opinion,
dude's earned the right. I mean, come on,
the dude can wear a kilt. I don't care.
Dude, you wear a kilt.
Exactly. You know, kilts are cool. Yeah, like I said, I don't care what that dude wants to wear. If he can do something impressive like that, I say give him a pass on whatever other weird stuff he does.
Yeah, I mean, it's just crazy where science and technology has allowed us to go now. And, you know, I'm really curious. Hopefully, you know, this thing, you know, we'll be able to get some sunlight, get the solar panels and everything activated. And, you know,
I think the main mission
was to actually, you know, try to start drilling on the surface. And, you know, I've heard
we're one step closer to the Armageddon movie, you know. So, this may be the next step of saving us from an asteroid someday.
Dude, I saw another study that showed how many asteroid impacts have occurred and like,
we are in a shooting gallery.
Yeah, it's pretty much science has said, yeah, it happens all the time. So
yeah, you're all gonna die. And the other thing that's kind of cool about this is for the first time we actually know what a comet sounds like. So like I said, we'll play a little bit of that what I'm dubbing space dubstep, because they say it's from the
minus the wobble bass.
Yeah, when the bass drops. But the magnetic field of the comet fluctuates, and it's actually causing a radio signal that we're able to pick up and record, and it sounds kind of creepy.
Yeah, I was actually on some forums, you know, just looking at the darker side of the web, and I ventured down a rabbit hole, and, you know, there was actually a group of people claiming that was alien technology trying to communicate with us and everything else.
That's what dubstep is, man. It's, it's alien metal. Yeah, I mean, just listen to this. This is some creepy, creepy music.
Yeah,
drop some bass on this, and this
yeah,
be,
I mean, we might have to do a remix using this or something. I mean, it's just
metal.
Nothing like what I would expect to hear.
All right, and is that now you've heard your alien music and we've creeped you out? Let's go into something a little bit lighter news and proof that scientists have way too much time on their hands.
Yay! Let's hear it for the exciting days of physics! Yay!
scientists are talking about how Thor's hammer works and why can only Thor pick it up. Some people have actually released some official studies of what they think is causing Thor's hammer to only be able to be lifted by Thor and other people worthy of being Thor.
Yeah, I mean, it's great to see the Hadron Collider at CERN being used for this type of research.
Yeah, I think they even said it in some of the movies that the Asgardian technology is so far advanced, it appears to be magic to us. Like a caveman would think, you know, our cell phones are, you know, weird wizard stuff. So one of the theories is, like you see in the first Thor movie where Odin, you know, wishes, like, you know, he who has the power of, you know, can lift the hammer will have the power of Thor. That's almost like a voice command on your phone, like, you know, Google whatever. Your
let's
Siri.
Not discriminate. Yeah, throw Siri out there.
All right, we'll throw some Siri out there. So one of the theories is Mjolnir, as it's called, is made out of some... Because originally they were like, one of the theories was, oh, it's made out of some kind of neutron star matter, which would be super, super dense and weigh like, I don't know, 300 billion elephants or something like that. But as we see in the recent Avengers 2 clip, Thor sits on a coffee table. If it was really that heavy, it would have crushed the table and probably fallen into the next couple floors. So the fact that it's appears light until someone tries to pick it up is one of the things that they're like, how's that shit work? And one of the theories is that it's whatever, I think they said it's made out of Euro, which is a fictional thing. But one of the, as these you know, the Siren, you know, big collider. They're discovering a lot of elements that we, not really element, but particles and stuff, that like dark matter. And like now we know, you know, dark matter is a thing. The universe is comprised of a lot of dark matter. And another thing that's so far a theoretical substance, but, you know, is, they believe is, you know, moments away from discovery, is gravitrons, which is a particle that controls gravity. And their thing is that this, the hammer, when it detects someone who is not Thor, will actually increase the gravity to counteract, you know, whatever pressure is trying to, the force that's trying to lift the hammer. So, like, for example, if you weigh 150 pounds and you're standing on something, well, the Earth is exerting 150 pounds back at you. So if it was doing less force, you would sink in. If it's doing too much force, it would knock you into the atmosphere. So there's that balance on everything. Well, so when Tony Stark tries to pick it up with the Iron Man suit and exerts, you know, 1,200 pounds of pressure, the hammer releases gravitrons that counteract that with 1,200 pounds of reverse force. So it never gets heavier than what it's laying on, but it just increases the force necessary to hold it in place.
Man, we're getting into some crazy-ish here.
I mean, Newton's first law, you know, an object at rest stays at rest, an object in motion stays at motion. So, and I said, unless the water rate...
If there is no net force that acts upon it.
Yeah.
Keyword, net.
Yeah, which is, like I said, a counteracting of the positive and negative force. You know, whatever's pulling it up and pushing it down has to be equal. So with these gravitrons, that whatever technology is in the hammer releases, you know, calculates exactly how much force is being applied to it and exerts a negative force to counteract it. That way it doesn't get, you know, super heavy and crush Tony's coffee table.
Dude, I'm gonna need a nap. All right, my brain's like, holy crap. All right, awesome science segment, yay, I learned stuff. Now I gotta go research all of Sir Isaac Newton's
like I said, I failed physics in college. That's why I switched to biology, but I remember a few things. It's a lot of math, dude. It is a lot of math. And, you know, some scientists, I guess, didn't
just have... don't divide by zero. You'll be okay.
Apparently, somebody just had a little too much time on their hands to write a whole article about this. But yeah, with that, we'll be back here with some nerd news.
Stay tuned.
And now it's time for all things nerdy in nerd news.
And welcome to this week's episode of Nerd News. I'm your host, Brad Jackson.
Smoking Joe.
Whoa.
But I'm pretty sure they know who we are by now.
I think so. I mean,
probably an hour or so into the podcast. If they don't know by now, then yeah.
It's important that we keep branding our names.
Yeah.
So in continuation with the game theme, we're going to talk about two of the more recent games that we played, Call of Duty, Advanced Warfare, and The Evil Within. And we're going to kind of go to a little bit different review, you know, talk about some of the things that we like about the games, but, you know, try not to go ahead and give away all the synopsis and, you know, the beauty of the gameplay.
What, no spoilers?
I mean, we'll probably give away some spoilers, so if Fuck you're...
I'm out then.
You can't be out, dude. You're on the mic.
Oh, shit.
So... You more recently played Advanced Warfighter. I think I beat it, you know, the first night.
Advanced Warfare.
Yeah. Well, eventually, you know, we're going to not mix Tom Clancy and Call of Duty. So my apologies to the diehard Tom Clancy fans out there.
They kind of got a connection anyway, at least the games. Yeah, this newest version is definitely something new because it's the game mechanics of it have completely changed from if you've played the other Call of Duties and, you know, Black Ops,
Ghost,
Modern Warfare. I mean, this is what, the 12th edition of Call of Duty?
Yeah, I believe so. I mean,
it started off World War II and progressed now to the future.
And I'm glad, you know, I mean, don't get me wrong, I enjoyed the hell out of, you know, the original Call of Duty games, but I was so ready for something to come out other than World War II.
Yeah. I mean, the Black Ops games and then the Modern Warfare, like the three Modern Warfare games, or is it, they might be more than that, I'm not sure. They're all starting to blend together at this point. But yeah, I mean, it's basically the game mechanics haven't changed a whole lot. Yeah,
no,
it's still,
I mean,
basically
still basic
the same
control schemes and everything.
But this new one is doing, I mean, it's so different than what I've played in the past because, like I said, it does take place, it's set 30 years into the future, And now that we have these
freaking, you know, exoskeletons.
Yeah, these, like, you know, computer assisted battles. So now you're getting like almost superpowers in the game. So you can make these super jumps, or you can hover, or when you hit somebody, they go flying across the screen.
Almost has a, I mean, as I was playing through the campaign and everything, I mean, it reminded me very much of, you know, Halo in some aspects, you know, where it was futuristic, but it, you know, kind of, it lost some of the sci-fi element, I guess, you know, that Halo carries. You know, like Joe's saying, you know, with the exoskeletons, I mean, you do get, you know, a lot of different strategies and upgrades and different techniques that you can apply. You know, I kind of like how at the beginning of the missions, you know, you kind of get certain loadouts. Like this mission, you may have super jump.
Yeah.
This mission, you've got the riot shield or something. So, you know, it kind of forces you to switch up your battle technique. I mean, it's definitely not one of those games where I think with past Call of Duties where you're just going to run in headlong, murk everybody, and, you know, proceed to the next
stage. That was one of my problems when I first started playing it, and especially in the multiplayer, which we'll talk about later, is realizing I have those powers. I forget, you know, and I start trying to play it like, you know, normal Call of Duty when I'm just, like, you know, running and gunning. And then I'm like, oh, yeah, I can, like, jump over this building or, or, you know, kick in this door.
Either that or, you know, you throw out the freaking tag grenades, so that way the enemies actually populate. So if they're hidden behind a wall or something, then you almost get like an X-ray vision. So great to pick up on the snipers.
Well, they're cool too, because you're normal. Usually you've got your lethal and your tactical grenades, but now with each one you've got three or four different options. So you can, like, you hold down your grenade button and switch from the tagger
the button on the PS3
to the smoke to the flashbang, or with the
freaking EMPs.
Yeah, EMPs for like robotics and stuff, because there's drones and stuff flying around. You know, that'll short out electronics and stuff. And then even with your lethal grenades, you've got the smart grenades where, like, you throw it, and as long as you keep your crosshairs on somebody, the grenade will find them.
It almost kind of remind me, once again, kind of going back to Halo a little bit, almost reminded me a little bit of the plasma grenades, you know? I mean, a good, accurate throw of a plasma grenade, you weren't escaping it.
Especially with those stickies, too, where it'd, like, stick onto her. Yeah, those, like, those seeker grenades. I mean, then they had, like, the regular standard grenades, but, yeah, those smart grenades were awesome. I used the hell out of those.
Yeah, and I, you know, this game, I actually found myself a little bit in certain levels actually having to be a little bit conservative with my ammo and things of that nature. I mean, it's, yeah, you still get to pick up, you know, people's weapons, but what I was finding were, you know, in previous Call of Duties where the gun was pretty much always full on ammo, this time around you pick one up and it's like, oh crap, I only got 12 shots. So
yeah, I know. And there's like, and yeah, I don't want to spoil anything about the story, but there's a certain level where you're injured, so you've only got one hand and you can't reload your weapon. So as soon as your weapon runs out of ammo, you're out of ammo. You got to go find another weapon because you can't carry more than what fits in the gun at one time. And that definitely added a level of difficulty to those.
Yeah, and I like, you know, level. Some of the incorporations, you know, certain levels you were able to drive different vehicles and stuff. I thought that was a fun switch up. And then, you know, being able to, you know, get into some of the more advanced armor and things of that nature. So there was, you know, a lot that this game brought to the table that, you know.
And it was also, I don't know if you noticed this or not, the heads-up display changed. Because normally you get like a heads-up display where you're, your ammo and all that stuff is on your screen, but in this one, it's all on the gun.
Yeah.
So there's not nothing cluttering up your screen, so it's more immersive.
And that was one of the, you know, I ran into a couple of instances where lighting is key on this game. You know, I can remember being in a couple of shadows being pinned down by, you know, a group of 8 or 10 people in front of me, and I'm trying to switch through my different grenades and not being able to read the text on the grenade, I found a lot of times was almost detrimental, you know, where I'm like, crap, I got to get a frag out there, and it was almost like EMP or something, and that's absolutely useless.
Yeah, it almost made it more realistic because you were having to look at the readouts on the sights instead of being on the screen, so you're having to look at your gun to see, you know, your ammo and your various add-on weapons and special abilities and stuff.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, being a fan of Call of Duty, you know, every time that a new one comes out, I'm like, great, it's just going to kind of be the same game over and over. This one, you know, I actually felt things that got switched up enough, it almost had a little bit different game. You know, the campaign this time around actually took a little bit of a challenge, and, you know, most of the time where I'm able to beat them in, you know, 3 or 4 hours, this one, you know, kind of doubled that time frame. So
that's another thing, too, is the cinematic element of the storyline. And seeing that
freaking Kevin Spacey in here. And
we're seeing that with a lot more of the modern games, where it's not just a gaming experience, where it's an actual cinematic experience.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like you're watching a featured film, and yeah, then, you know, in the key moments, oh crap, I got to act this next scene out.
Yeah. I mean, there is a full fleshed out storyline, and that's another thing too. The game, it's definitely made differently than most of the games I've recently played, because it's not just, you know, normally old school, it's an animated character and the guys are just doing voiceover with it. But with this game and a lot of the more modern games that are coming out, they're doing full motion capture acting. So the guy you see on the screen is not just an animated character with some other actor's voice. It's the actual actor. Your main guy you're playing Private Mitchell. It's that the guy you see on screen is actually Troy
Baker in this one, Troy Jackson, Baker. So, you know, I mean,
yeah, but Troy Baker, I mean, he's like a huge voice actor. He does just about anything animated recently, or a lot of the games Lord of the Rings game. He's in that. I mean, dude's in everything, but you actually see him on the screen. That's
I'm looking
him
forward
acting.
To that game too, because the last Lord of the Rings that I played was, I believe, War of the North, and that was a fun game.
Yeah, I mean, but you actually see them acting. It's not just, you know, an animated character. It's them doing the full mocap with, you know, so it's, you actually see the guys that are portraying the characters. Like I said, you actually see Kevin Spacey in the game, and like I said, Troy Baker and all these guys. It's not, you know, voice acting is not, you know, I don't want to say it's less difficult than regular acting, but you know, it's definitely, actually have to act out the part, it definitely adds more to their performance, I think, than just, you know, sitting in a booth, you know, doing
absolutely.
A voiceover.
So, I mean, for me, out of a scorer out of 10 on this game, I think I'm going to give it a 7.5.
Yeah, it's definitely badass. And I don't know did you have a chance to play any of the multiplayer?
I did not play any of the multiplayer. I did beat the campaign. You know, I basically played for about 8 hours straight, on hard difficulty. And there were a few challenges that, you know, a couple of spots where I was just like...
It took me a while to get through that one-armed bandit level where I'm like, shit, I'm out of ammo. Gotta find a gun.
Yeah.
But the multiplayer, I played some of it, and it's that added element of the exosuits are insane because, yeah, like I said, I started off playing like regular Call of Duty where I'm just running around, and I'm like, oh, shit, I'm trying to shoot this guy, and he just jumped over me, or, you know, jumped up to, like, the next level of building and took off, or... Yeah, super speed. That's definitely a new element to it that makes it a little more difficult.
Yeah, speaking of difficult, I want to jump into a game I'm playing currently that is just kicking my ass left and right, The Evil Within. And this is a survival horror game made by the same people that did Resident Evil 4. And you see a lot of the same tie-ins from Resident Evil 4 that you see, you know, in The Evil Within. But it also did bring a lot to, you know, a lot of new things to the table. But I will say that this is definitely a gamer's game, as it is extremely challenging. I think I died probably 14 or 15 times
I had a chance to play
one or two
it
missions.
But what I've seen of it, it looks more like the original Resident Evil. It's that it's gone back to that where you're not overpowered, you're, you know, low on ammo, and
you
gotta run
ammo. But, you know, at the same time where you're trying to run, you also got to be cognizant of your surroundings, because there are booby traps. I mean, there's bear traps on the ground, there's bombs and tripwires set up, so I mean, just all over the place there are things that, you know, if one of the freaking villains doesn't get you, are running out of ammo, then, you know, it's something where you got full health and you just walked into a bomb. So, oh, we're sorry. You're dead. So
what are you fighting in this game? I mean, is it demons, ghosts, zombies?
It's kind of a mix. I mean, you start out in a same asylum, and it kind of has a little bit of a paranoia, Silent Hill type feel. But I mean, you're getting, you know, from Resident Evil 4, the freaking, you know, zombies with chainsaws. You got a whole bunch of, you know, just freaking insane looking people coming after you with anything from machetes to guns themselves.
More of the intelligent monster.
Oh yeah, you know, and it's crazy. You know, this is another game that really forces you to, you know, be very tactical. You know, in a lot of instances, you've got, you know, three or four bullets, and you know, this kind of follows the same setup. You get a pistol. If you find enough parts in the location, you can get a crossbow, and the crossbow is kind of cool because you get enhanced ammo.
You just went around pretending you're Daryl Dixon. That's all you really wanted to do.
Well, I mean, you know, you. Like for the bombs and stuff, you know, it's a time puzzle. So you hit that time puzzle right. Well, you get parts. As you collect more parts, you're able to build, you know, bolts for your crossbow. So they can, you know, be electrocharged. They can have grenades on them. You know, just a whole host of different effects, which are absolutely crucial for taking down some of the heavier hitters. And, you know, that's another thing about this game is so many of the monsters, if you're running around full health, well, too bad, because they're one hit, one kill. So, you know, it forces you in some instances to
use a lot of cardio.
Yeah, a lot of stealth. You know, there's glass bottles and stuff that you have to use to, you know, distract monsters so you can get through, you know, certain areas of the game. And, I mean, it is a gamer's game. You know, I was looking for a challenge, and this absolutely, you know, brought it to the table. So I may not be as hardcore of, you know, a gamer as some folks, but you know, it's definitely putting me through my paces.
Yeah, I've got to play that one. I've not had a chance to pick it up yet.
You know, if I had to compare it to another game that most people are familiar with, I would say it's on the same par of difficulty as Ninja Gaiden.
I didn't have any problem with Ninja Gaiden. You just suck.
Yeah, I mean, well, that could be, you know. I mean, I'm sorry, I got a mortgage and, you know,
yeah,
everything.
We don't have time to spend days playing a game like we used to. This is the bad part about growing up, folks.
You know, my score on Evil Within, I'm probably going to give that game probably a 9 out of 10.
Cool. And one thing I want to go back to the Call of Duty as well. One thing I liked about it is, you know, it is the future. But some of the equipment you see, you can see where it's a more advanced version of stuff we're using today. Like I said, you know, the drones we're using today, it looks like what the inevitable extension of that stuff is. And even the exosuit, they're actually, because I think we talked about the Iron Man suits before that the military has been experimenting with. And these exosuits you use looks like, you know, what is, you know, looks almost like the experimental stuff that we're using now. It looks like, you know, the actual legit finished version of the stuff that's, you know, in the experimental phase now. So I thought that was kind of cool.
Absolutely. It just makes you kind of question, you know, where technology is going. So, you know, the holidays are coming up. So if you're looking for games to sit down and, you know, spend some time with, I would say Call of Duty, The Evil Within.
Yeah, this episode will be up for Black Friday. So definitely go buy some board games that, like we discussed earlier, and you know, some video games and all that good stuff.
Yeah, and what we're going to do tonight, folks, is we're actually going to hook up our Atari 2600 to a modern TV, and I'm so excited.
You're going to play some E.T.
I don't know, but I am proud to say I'm an original owner of the E.T. game. I didn't have to get mine out of a desert.
That's what happens when you clean out your basement, folks. You find weird games from days past. Well, I think that about wraps us up, but we do have a big shout-out this week. We've just got our official Cigar Nerds smoking shirts in.
Absolutely, and I got to say, quality shirts, quality podcasters.
These shirts come from realmensmokecigars.com. Like I said,
and don't order a short shirt unless you're a real man. I'm just going to throw it out there because we will revoke your man card. Booyah!
Yeah, that's another thing that these shirts came with is we got our official man cards, which if you order them from the website, you have to take a test to prove you're a real man before you can get your man cards. But they also have realwomensmokecigars.com, the same company. They make some girl shirts too. And yeah, they've got some amazing shirts on their side. There's all kind of nerdy stuff. I mean, you get Wolverine. I'm sure you've seen the pictures of my Boba Fett shirt that came from the same company. And it's part
Dude,
of the...
I thought that was the only shirt you owned.
Yeah, pretty much. That's all I ever wear. Yeah, and it's part of the Molina ad group. Like I said, they do all kind of marketing stuff. So they even made our badass Cigar Nerds business cards. So if you see us out and about, you know, and we lay one of these cards on you, it came from the same guys that made our shirts. And like I said, our shirts are awesome. I've just posted a bunch of pictures on our Facebook page, so you can go there and check out our shirts. And they also have a cigar company, too, that we're going to be, you know, preview for next week. We'll be reviewing
this
some of their
foreshadowing
cigars,
folks.
Yeah, but yeah. If you want to check out your own shirts, like I said, realmensmokecigars.com, and you know, hey, shoot us an email if you like our shirts. We may, you know, make them available for purchase at some point when we figure out the easiest way to accomplish that. But if you want to look like an official cigar nerd, you're going to have the Cigar Nerd shirt.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, big shout out to my man George.
Yeah, so any other and he is a podcast listener, folks, so yeah.
I think he was one of our first official fans to say, hey, you guys are on to something here. So we appreciate the props, and in turn we shall give you props.
So any other shout outs or final thoughts there, Brad?
No, my final thoughts is I'm gonna smoke this batch cigar and figure out an Atari 2600.
And with that, don't forget to check us out on our Facebook page, tweet us at Cigar Nerd Pod, and check out our website, CigarNerdPodcast.com. Also, you can see us get us on the ESO podcast.com, since we're all part of the ESO network now. Go to their
shout
website.
Out to you guys as well.
Go to their website, check out their Amazon store, help support the network that supports us. And with that, our final for the day, I think I'm going to steal Will Wheaton's sign off this week and play more games. And this has been a recording of the Cigar Nerd Podcast. We're your hosts, Smokin' Joe and Brad Jackson. Join us next time for more adventures in nerddom.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at ESONetwork.com.